I might at some points go and stand over there and point to things because it's an anatomy-based paper. The history, the kind of internal history of science of smelling is actually pretty brief. Mainstream biology more or less ignored smelling till about 12 years ago, specifically 2004, when the Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine was awarded to Richard Axel and Linda Buck for their discoveries of odorant receptors and the organisation of the olfactory system. In a paper published the following year in Physiological Reviews in 2005, it was noted that up to that point, smelling had mainly been considered a matter for poetry or the perfume industry. So it's great that we've got poetry at this meeting. And I've brought some animal perfume stroke pheromones with me. I was going to hand them out, but I was pounced on for drinking some coffee in here, so I think probably spreading pheromones around about here isn't a very good idea. So I'll put them on outside somewhere, and you can help yourself to them. Like all drugs, use them responsibly. Don't eat them, and don't lick them, and don't touch your animals with them. They're actually designed to be wiped onto surfaces. So if you've got a cat, or you've got a friend who's got a cat, you can see the effect of that. I'll come back to it later on. So that Nobel citation described smell as the most enigmatic of the senses, with few basic principles being understood. That's really probably just a classic and very straightforward case of anthropocentrism in biology, because we humans privilege vision above everything else. We're not really an olfactory species. It's the same kind of bias that led to comparative anatomy's historical preoccupation with the relative sizes of different parts of the brain, emphasising the cerebral expansion in humans. But as animal welfare scientist Donald Broom notes, humans have an incredibly anthropocentric view of the best type of brain to have. In his book, How Dogs Love Us, neuroscientist Gregory Byrne states that a dog's sense of smell is about 100,000 times more powerful than that of a human's. And I'm sure you've probably heard similar statements, although that multiplier seems to vary depending on where and what you read. I've read figures of dogs' sense of smell ranging from 20 to 200,000, even up to a million times that of human. And what can that possibly mean for a dog? What would it be like to smell like that? If we use Burns's figure, does it mean that dogs smell things 100,000 times more intensely than we do? In that case, you would think that cohabiting with a human would be almost unbearable, and indeed would be a major welfare issue. Imagine experiencing a room air freshener or cigarette smoke at 100,000 times the intensity of our own olfactory perception. In thinking about how we live with animals, we give really pretty scant regard to their experiences of smell. There's been a little bit of work done on this. This is 2004, coincidentally the date that the olfaction prize was given. And we see some things emerging out of animal welfare science literature. So this study, for example, shows the relationship between a chemical, ammonia, in this case, coming from the deep litter system in a broiler shed, and its relationship to weight gain, and also its relationship to death, actually, as you can see there. But it doesn't really say anything about olfaction, and it makes only a pretty crude and indirect point about the relationship between attending to an animal's sensory experience as an essential aspect of his or her well-being. Indeed, it was this type of study which the Bramble Committee in 1965 rejected as a basis on which to assess welfare, by stating that production parameters are not by themselves reliable indicators of welfare. If we go back to the dogs and we come down a factor of 10 from Burns and see dogs as having 10,000 times our sense of smell, and we then translate that to vision, that would mean that what you and I can see at a third of a mile, a dog could see at more than 3,000 miles away, with the same amount of detail. So it really is quite hard to make sense of it in more ways than one, and perhaps comparing across different senses like that isn't really very helpful anyway. I mean, we can look at olfactory cell numbers, and the 20 times figure that I mentioned probably comes from the fact that dogs have about 20 to 40 times more olfactory receptor cells than we do, and I just see that slide actually is more like 60 for the maximum, but it's that sort of ballpark that tends to be quoted. So, and if we look at the olfactory epithelium, so that's the sheet of tissue that's made up of these cells, then we see that figure of approximately 20 coming up again if we compare across humans and dogs. But the receptor cell, the olfactory receptor cell, is really only part of the story. In fact, it's only the very beginning of the story, because it's what happens when those receptors activate, how the response gets modulated and processed into a sense perception that creates the experience of smelling and the meaning of smelling to the smeller. So it's a picture of my old dog Nipper. He's a little brown and white one, sadly no longer with us. And that's him with his friend Agnes, Scottish Terrier. And in the picture on the left there, they've both got their noses down, smelling. And you know, take them away from there, they both go back there and they're smelling that grass like anything. They're totally absorbed in that process. Now, out of shot are me and my neighbour. You can just see Anna's legs there and her walking stick. She's an 84-year-old retired PE teacher, and we walked our dogs together frequently. And I can guarantee that we were probably moaning about how impossible it was to take these two canine OAPs for a decent walk, because all they want to do is sniff the whole time. It does get incredibly frustrating. And if you've got a certain kind of goal-directed view of the dog walk as a purposeful journey from A to B, and I think Anna and I tend to share that, then this constant sniffing and smelling really does drive you nuts. So I thought about this because I had two older dogs in a row, because I rehomed Nipper as an old chap, and my previous dog had lived a long time too. So I was watching how smelling was affecting her as she got older. And this is where I live in Edinburgh. I'm very lucky to live near Holyrood Park. In fact, that's Hermit's Croft is actually where I stay there. And so my walks with Nipper when he was a younger, older dog, we typically have gone round Hunter's Bog here, right this lovely part of Edinburgh to ground, round by Holyrood and down, it's a bit up and down, it's a bit kind of hilly, but that would be a kind of standard walk. Sometimes I might go in that way a little bit. And then when I reflected on this talk about what smell means to the companion dog, and I realised that, you know, over the years, the walk, if you traced the journey of the walk, there it changes, and at some point, and I don't know when, we stopped going into the middle of Arthur's Seat. We started to go around this nether hill there. It's a little bit of an easier walk, and it kind of had that pattern to it. And then at another time, it became a little bit shorter still, and I recognised most of the walks that we shared with Agnes and Anna were in this sort of area here as the dogs got older. And then shorter still again, round here. So there's a kind of diminishing length of the kind of geographical horizons of these dog walks, so that they became latterly, when Nipper was very, very old, made just a little donder out a patch of grass, basically. But it was as if the intensity of his sniffing experiences increased to compensate for the reducing distance of the walk, so that if you did a graph, kind of linear graph of the number of steps and the number of sniffs plotted against time on the same axis, it would look like a big cross. So with sniffing increasing as the length of the walk decreased. But as a dog owner, what I didn't really cotton on to in this kind of notional equation of the dog walk was that the time t should remain constant. In other words, The very elderly nipper should have been allowed to sniff out the duration of a normal dog walk of his younger years and not be shortchanged just because my spatial idea of the walk as a distance of ground covered was no longer being achieved. Because as all dog senses fail, it seems like the sense of smell gets maintained, or maybe it fails too, but because it's got such a much higher starting point, you don't notice it as much. So it took me a long time to realise this and to accept that the sniffing walk of an older dog as should be kind of proper exercise for the nose, if you like. And then I read Alexandra Horowitz's book, Inside of a Dog, writing about her own dog, Pump, in a chapter called Sniff. She says, "Since I've begun to appreciate Pump's smelly world, I sometimes take her out to just sit and sniff. We have smell walks, stopping at every landmark along our routes in which she shows an interest. She is looking. Being outside is the most smelly, wonderful part of her day. I won't cut that short. I even look at photographs of her differently. Where she once looked to be pensively staring in the distance, I now think what she's really doing is smelling some exciting air from a far-flung source." And I think I can understand what she means, because I recognise it in dogs. And it's interesting how she suggests that Pump is looking through smell. So I now get pretty uncomfortable when I see people pulling their dogs along when they're trying to sniff something, because you do see it all the time outside. It must be like having the page of a newspaper or a computer screen flicked away from you every 2 seconds, even before you've had a chance to get the gist of a story or even a headline. Because the sensory world of dogs, their umwelt, is so different from ours. As Simon Gabwa and Catherine Reeve state in their paper, Canine Olfaction, Scent, Sign and Situation, dogs live in a world of P-mails, not emails, and Nosebook, not Facebook. Theirs is a world where particles of scent carry their own chronology, and where a lamppost or a tree stump becomes a bulletin board of newer and older notices, date stamped with olfactory markers and personal identifiers. I think that analogy of a bulletin board is really accurate, because you do have older notices that are fading and no longer relevant, as well as new ones that have just been put up and perhaps more immediate. So how can we even begin to approach understanding that? Perhaps it really is only through poetry, as the Physiological Review article mentioned. In Andre Alexis's wonderful novel, 15 Dogs, a doggy description of the smell of a lake is given, and this is what he wrote. "They were, it has to be said, almost instinctively drawn to the lake shore. Its confluence of reeks was as bewitching to the dogs as the smell of an early morning bakery is to humans. There was first the smell of the lake itself, sour, vegetal, fishy. Then there was the smell of geese, ducks, and other birds. More enticing still, there was the smell of bird shit, which was like a kind of hard salad sautéed in goose fat. Finally, there were more evanescent whiffs, cooked pork, tomatoes, grease from cow's meat, corn, bread, sweetness, and milk. None of them could resist it." So in veterinary circles, experts on olfaction, I've discovered, are really hard to find. And when you stop to think about it, that's incredible. It's even inexcusable. Of all the many specialties that are available in veterinary medicine, you would think that rhinology should be the largest and most important. An animal-centred veterinary medicine would be full of consultant rhinologists. One of the few is Dr. Lawrence Myers, who worked at Auburn School of Veterinary Medicine in the States in the Institute for Biological Detection Systems. And the work he did was mainly with bomb and drug sniffing dogs. He's actually the one that's been quoted as saying that dogs can smell a million times better than humans. In an interview about that, he said it was a speculative number, but a possible number, that he was using to illustrate a fairly narrow point. The reality, as already alluded to, is that there is no easy answer, because certainly no good studies have been done between dogs and humans. And if they were to be designed, dogs would have to be persuaded to tell us when they could just begin to smell something, And that would need extensive training. Probably wouldn't be impossible, but it's certainly not very easy. Olfaction in dogs is what vision is to humans, as suggested by Horovitz when she referred to pumps sniffing as a kind of canine looking. It's also their memory system, their primary sense of dealing with and being in the world. They smell in minute, high fidelity detail. So we can come up with things like dogs can detect a teaspoon of sugar dissolved in a million gallons of water or two Olympic-sized swimming pools. But even that doesn't adequately describe their acuity, because there's a technical problem of reducing the scent stimulus to small enough quantities to get readings of lower olfactory thresholds when smelling first becomes possible for dogs. So in his studies, Myers didn't deal in parts per million of odour. He was talking about parts per trillion or quintillion. So we really are moving towards the homeopathic concentrations here. In some cases, the dog's nose is sharper than the technology that's available to measure it. So morphologically, the nose of the dog contains this incredible amount of variation, more so than any other animal species, because of the line breeding that's taken place in dogs, and that can, within a few generations, change shapes dramatically. So we see this in the dog body as a whole. Think of a Chihuahua and a Great Dane, obviously. But we see it especially in the head and nose, where we recognise these three skull morphologies: brachycephalic, meaning short nose, mesocephalic or mesaticephalic, meaning medium, and dolichocephalic, meaning a relatively elongated nose, like a borzoi or sighthound, something like that. Now, the really significant aspect of all this is that while that bony conformation of the skull can be altered in relatively few generations to produce this degree of distortion, the soft tissue structures within the skull retain their former volume. So this causes all sorts of problems for brachycephalic dogs. They can't breathe as well and they can't lose heat. But what tends to also be ignored, I think, is that these dogs can't smell as well, because the olfactory mucosa within the nasal chambers is too compressed and the normal airflow patterns, which are crucial to canine sniffing, get interrupted. So something very important has been compromised when we do this to dogs. So we saw earlier the olfactory cells and the olfactory epithelium. I'm not quite sure how well this slide's coming out, but the epithelium is laid down on top of these bones called turbinate bones, and you might just get an impression of them in the depths of the nose there, sort of convoluted scroll-like bones, which you can see pretty easily in the skull. So they're very delicate and convoluted, and they increase the surface area and they create turbulence as the air flows over them. So the bones at the front of the nose are the maxillary turbinates, because they're near the maxilla or upper jaw. And the epithelium that covers these warms, cleans, and humidifies the inspired air. It's very important for respiratory system health. Now, in the dog nose, the main olfactory epithelium is located caudally, or towards the back, so it's in this area. So this is all the maxillary turbinates, and this is where olfaction takes place, up here. So these are the ethmoturbinates, because they're near the ethmoid bone. And they're this area is very close to the olfactory bulb of the brain. And that's an evolutionary thing, which tends to suggest the importance of olfaction and smelling. So it's a very short distance, and that olfactory nerve is a very short nerve. In fact, it's often considered an extension of the brain rather than a nerve as such. So when sniffing takes place, it's not the same as breathing. When dogs pant, most of the air, over 80% of it, actually bypasses this area. It goes here and down into the lungs. It takes the sort of bottom route, this ventral hiatus there. And panting is the main way dogs lose heat, because they don't sweat. So that's got some relevance to smelling as well. So dogs don't have sweat glands on their bodies like we do. The only place they've really got sweat glands is on the their paw pads, which is why when you see on veterinary consulting room tables little damp patches, because they're nervous and sweating, but they just sweat through their feet. But they don't have them elsewhere, so panting is incredibly important. But smelling is different. It pushes air into the upper airways, this dorsal chamber, as it's called, and then it reaches the olfactory epithelium back here. So it does quite a sharp turn. The air comes in and then it goes up to reach this area. And during the expiration phase of the sniff, so the breathing out phase, no air enters or exits that recess, so it just stays there. So there's quite prolonged exposure of the air that's been taken in to the olfactory receptors, so it allows them to sample the air. And the nose itself is beautifully designed for sniffing. So the expired air, the air that comes out, exits the nostril in a kind of what we call ventrolateral, so down into the side sort of vortex. And that's why they've got this little slit here, little lateral slit. So it kind of goes out that way. And what that does is it minimises rebreathing of the expired air and promotes inspiration of fresh air samples. And it also creates a little vortex at the side which stirs up ambient odours that might otherwise have been not accessible. So the manner in which the air is exhaled actually helps the dog, or this applies to lots of species obviously, using the dog as the type species, it helps the dog to sniff. And in dogs that have been bred for sniffing, like the bloodhound, there are a lot of these factors are seen in greater magnification, I guess. And it's thought that their huge floppy ears, they kind of amplify this effect by creating and walling off a zone of turbulence around the nose. So they create a kind of box that it enables that sniffing to take place more effectively. Because dogs can sniff more or less continuously, they can keep sniffing going. They can also move their nostrils independently, which most of us can't, and that helps them lateralize a scent. So when you see a dog like a bloodhound on a scent, it will go from side to side to locate the scent and pick it up again when it's lost. So that's the kind of macroscopic anatomy, or gross anatomy as it's sometimes called, what we see with the naked eye. What about at a more microscopic level and getting on to kind of cell biology level? So we've looked at the olfactory cell before, and it's a type of nerve cell. So in other words, it generates minute electrical charges which go to the brain and create the perception smell. So an olfactory cell has to detect something in the environment, an odorant, which sets in chain a sequence of events resulting in our sense of smell, which is mediated by these electrical changes in the brain and this Cartesian review that we're doing here. So here's our olfactory cell there. Here's a little receptor cilia. Here's your odorant particles or molecules. So this is the outside, this is the nasal chamber here, and this is the inside of the epithelium and the nerves up there. This is an interesting Bowman's gland. This produces a substance, a kind of mucoid-like substance which traps odor particles. That's the idea, and it renders them more susceptible to interaction with the olfactory cell. And we've also got these interesting cells, basal cells. These are a type of stem cell, and all that means is that they can become any cell they like. So they change, and they can become they can develop into a receptor cell or a supporting cell, depending on what's needed. And amazingly, this whole structure replaces itself about every 2 to 4 weeks. Come back to that shortly. That is, and it's the basal cells that do that. They regenerate, and they can go wrong like all of these stem cells. So they can produce cancer cells. So a basal cell carcinoma is quite a common cancer of the nose. So there are millions of these cells in the olfactory epithelium. So that when smelling takes place, this is the current, this is the view that you know, the Nobel Prize kind of thing. What happens is that you get a scent, which is made up of lots of different odorant molecules. So the animal inhales a whiff of that, which is just a big mix. Then each odorant finds a specific receptor cell. It's done by colour here. I hope you can see it. So the blue or the purple matches up with the purple. The red matches up with the red. So that's indicating that each odorant, there's a specific receptor cell that's for that odorant or an odorant very closely related to it. So it's a bit like a lock and a key. The odorant molecule will only lock on to that specific receptor cell. If it's not the right shape, it just drops out again, nothing happens. But when it does fit in and it meets its correct receptor, there then follows a sequence of changes, a bit like a kind of domino reaction, which it takes place at an intracellular level, and we'll look at that in a minute, and that results in the nerve firing off. So if we go down a bit further, actually into the cell, so this is more diagrammatic and abstract, but it's just reflecting what goes on in the cell. So this is the outside of the cell in the nasal passages here, this is in the cell, this is the cell membrane, also called the plasma membrane, and this is our receptor here, but it's depicted slightly differently. It's indicating that what that receptor actually is a chain of amino acids, which is the smallest building block in a protein. So the receptor is a chain, and the fascinating thing is it crosses the membrane 7 times, all of the receptors do that, and it's folded in different ways. And it's that folding of the amino acid on itself that creates this kind of shapely pocket for each odorant, so a triangular one in this case, but a different odorant, it would be a different shape. So when you inhale the odorant and it lands down and it finds the right receptor, that kind of reaction, that binding, triggers a change in this thing here, which is called a G protein. And it doesn't really matter what that's all about. It changes the shape of the G protein. That changes shape and it affects an enzyme which catalyzes this reaction here. So it's just like a kind of a sequence that gets started by this receptor finding the right thing. These G proteins were discovered in the 1990s, and they're all involved in some way in transmitting signals from the outside of the cell into the inside of the cell and then doing something about it. So that's what happens here. It just has a couple of chemical reactions, and the end result is that there's actually a channel in the cell membrane or a gate which opens. Now when that gate opens, because the inside of a cell is normally got a slightly more negative charge, positive particles or ions, sodium ions and calcium ions, want to rush in because it's like, you know, unlike charges attract each other. So the sodium ions flow into the cell when that gate opens, and that creates a potential difference, an electrical charge difference across the cell membrane, which then gets propagated, and that's what a nerve impulse is. So it's a kind of that's a very fundamental kind of part of cell biology, of how signaling happens within a cell. Basically, something happens here, it changes a sequence of reactions, a gate opens, sodium rushes in, and we get a charge difference, and that's what we understand a nerve cell to be firing. And that's then propagated along the nerve to the brain. So a really key thing about it is, and this is a really interesting thing about it is that each of these olfactory cells only expresses one odorant receptor. That's what the different colours are representing. Now, humans can recognise about 10,000 odours. And what all that Nobel stuff was about was the idea that they discovered 1,000 genes for olfaction. Now, humans have about 30,000 genes that code for proteins, so that's a third of the 3% of the genome. is involved in olfaction. So you've got these 1,000 genes which are producing these cells, each of which has got one receptor on them. But because each cell can detect closely related odorants, that's how you get 10,000 odors from only 1,000 genes. So, you know, on average, each odorant will detect about 10 closely related odorants. So the term for an odorant mosaic is often used. So basically, that's how you get 10,000 odors from only 1,000 genes. So I mentioned earlier that this epithelium is constantly regenerating thanks to the basal cells, which are stem cells or pluripotential cells. They can go into anything. But those replacement cells, when they function, don't automatically have to be the same type as initially. So it doesn't have to be a red one next time. It could be a green one or it could be a blue one. And what has been found is that animals, and particularly dogs, they develop more receptors for odours on which they've been trained or exposed to. So there's quite a bit of plasticity in the system. And this complicates this idea about innate sensory acuity, because it means that actually all these thresholds are pretty movable. So in other words, a dog or any animal trained for a particular scent will actually gradually develop more and more receptors for that particular odorant mosaic or that scent. And so they become more and more sensitive to it. So that a dog may start off by being able to detect 10 parts per billion. And then after several months, so after several iterations of this replacement of the epithelium, they may detect 1 to 2 parts per trillion at that point. And comparative studies have found that macrosomic animals like rodents and dogs have a much larger olfactory gene repertoire than microsomic animals like ourselves, where we use the sense of smell far less. So that's why they get this definition. So I like to think of it in this way. So I love the smell of Linda McCartney sausage rolls, which is a kind of comfort food. And you can see how in need of comfort I was in the way I got into that. Nipper also liked these. He liked them on the general principle that any human food was better than dog food. So whereas I might smell them and think, Linda McCartney sausage rolls, comfort food. I think he would smell them. He might think, I smell some rehydrated textured soya protein, also onion, pea protein, wheat, sunflower oil, salt, palm oil. It's been cooked in a tray that once cooked chicken and touched by a human hand I know who ate an orange couple of days ago. That might be how he can tell. Or rather more poetically, in fact much more poetically, there's a beautiful line in John Berger's novel King, a street story. It's a story about a dog, and the dog narrates the story. The dog lives with homeless people, which illustrates this, because fairly early on in the book, the canine narrator asks of the reader, somewhat disbelievingly, "You've never smelt diamonds." The idea that a dog could smell diamonds, which to King smell a bit like a petrol filling station. So it's time now to turn to the other second sensory system in the nose and talk a little bit about pheromones. And that's what I've brought for you, which we can get and test later. The idea of pheromones, or chemical messengers, that influence animal behaviour, has actually been around for a long time. They were certainly known about in ancient Greece, but the name or term pheromone was first coined in 1959 by Peter Carlson and Martin Lucier, following the first chemical identification of a pheromone. And it was the substance that was named bombycol, the great term, which was isolated from the silk moth Bombyx mori. Now, the paper describing bombycol utilises what is the equivalent of Koch's postulates. Now, for bacteriologists or microbiologists, Koch's postulates is a set of paradigmatic rules which indicate how to isolate, identify, synthesise, and then test a putative substance to make sure it is what you think it is, and it is you know, it has a desired effect. So they did this with this pheromone, proving its unique and specific identity and effect within that paradigm. So the term pheromone sounds a bit like hormone. Hormones being the chemicals generated from the endocrine glands in the body, for example, the adrenal glands, and which then influenced the body that made them in some way. Hormone comes from a root which means to excite, and the Greek pherein means to transfer, so that the definition of a pheromone is a substance secreted or transferred to the outside of an individual and received by a second individual of the same species in which it causes or excites a specific reaction or a definite behaviour. And the commonest reaction is known as the Flamen response or Flamen reaction, which intriguingly dogs don't actually show, but you can see it demonstrated in these other species here. So this initial classic response to pheromone is seen in many animals. The animal adopts this rather strange facial expression as it receives the pheromone. Cats kind of drop their lower jaw slightly. So pheromones are found in everything from algae and bacteria to insects and mammals, although how algae perform the Flamen reaction, I'm not quite sure how that looks. But crucially, they're different from what biologists call signature odours, which are more complex and individual scents. And these can be learned by animals, especially social insects like ants and bees, and they're used for colony recognition. Pheromones are smaller, much barer molecules, and they're recognised alone or in very precise combinations, like this molecule, Z7-dodecan-1-L-acetate, just trips off the tongue. And this is a sex pheromone of the female Indian elephant, which is amazingly also found in about 140 different species of moth as well. Pheromones are associated with a specific receptor in the nose. So this is not the olfactory system. And this receptor is the vomeronasal organ, also known as Jacobson's organ, although anatomists prefer the term vomeronasal because it relates to the bones in the vicinity. So here we see it in a snake there. And the vomeronasal organ has its own nerves, leading to a part of the brain devoted to interpreting the signals that are transduced from the pheromone receptors. So it's a similar sort of process to olfaction, but it's happening separately for the most part. Now, access to the vomeronasal organ is through two small openings in the upper jaw, just behind the upper incisor teeth. It's probably easier to see on this cat. It's just that little bleb there. This is it on the dog. Very easy to see when your dog yawns or your cat yawns, if you're in the right position. This cat has a problem here. She fell from a balcony and split. That's not normal. But that's the incisive papilla there. And leading from that little nipple-like thing are two water-filled ducts, the incisive ducts, which transfer the pheromone solution to the vomeronasal organ, where the reception will elicit the Flamen reaction and then other behaviours. So a huge number of land mammals, insects, crustacea, nematodes and other species have a vomeronasal organ, but not humans. And in humans, one argument was that this organ was lost in evolution as colour vision developed. Therefore, it was assumed that humans didn't use pheromone communication, relying instead on visual signalling for things like sexual behaviour. However, in 2005, that year again, it was discovered that pheromones can actually stimulate both the vomeronasal organ and olfactory cells, meaning that humans could and probably were responsive to them, even if no human pheromone has yet been comprehensively identified. The nearest equivalent so far is a molecule from the axilla or armpit area of women that seems to cause menstrual synchrony in females living in close quarters, and you see that in other species as well. It's very often seen in dogs. But so far, the specific nature of that molecule hasn't been identified. It's not been isolated and purified in that sense. So despite all the advertising to the contrary, there isn't a pheromone which is known to cause instant attraction available, even though the idea is alluring. In veterinary practice, the use of feromone extracts has become popular in treating certain behaviour stroke problems associated with anxiety and stress in companion animals. It's also been shown that horses perform better when they experience a maternal appeasing feromone. And feromones or their extracts are increasingly being put to use in clinics and wards to try to provide general reassurance for animals entering the facility or boarding there for a time. So this is an instance where we are actually starting to see some attention being given to the animal sensory experience and trying to take account of that in some way. So if this works, I just wanted to show this promotional video. It's for the feromone that examples that I've got there, because it shows the anatomy really nicely actually, but it also shows how these kinds of problems in animals are being medicalized, if you like, or are being taken seriously within veterinary medicine and are being turned into a pharmacological issue. It's not completely without controversy. Some people would always argue that you need behavioural treatment as well. But it's quite nice just from the anatomy, see if this works. No, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm.
Have we got sound?
Sorry, I didn't. You might have to do the sound on the laptop. Sorry.
Right. The sound is important actually. It's just some strange background. It's not cats. There you go. I love all the little cat heads on the wall.
Hello, Kitty.
So it's a separate area, that's the thing from the olfactory bulb. So this has become quite a big thing in companion animal practice, particularly as the cat is overtaking the dog as the number one companion animal. So that's it really. I mean, it's a kind of brief glimpse into the universe of olfaction. No. We've got the message. A few months ago, of course, gravitational waves were discovered. Although I prefer to think that it simply proves that the universe was designed by a chocolate-coloured Labrador retriever. Thank you very much.